Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. 10 years ago, the people in the Mideast rose up in what came to be known as Arab Spring. What has happened in the Mideast over the past 10 years? Have social movements pushed countries towards greater freedom and democracy? Or has there been a backlash of repression? And what's happening with the women in the region? Just last week, a three-day conference brought together women from the Mideast and Northern Africa to answer these important questions and discuss the current situation in the region. It was a fascinating discussion among women on the front lines for peace, freedom, and equality, including women judges and lawyers, elected officials, and leaders of civic organizations. Our guest today is the woman who convened this amazing gathering, Habak Osman. Habak is the founder of Karama, a movement to end violence against women and deliver sustainable, inclusive peace and democracy in Africa and the Mideast. Habak's work has encompassed reconciliation and peace building in her homeland of Somalia, and supporting grassroots women activists to secure their rights in the wake of the Arab revolutions. She is named one of the world's 500 most influential Muslims. Habak is a member of the UN Alliance of Civilizations Women's Alliance for Peace and has served on many advisory groups and boards. She is a senior fellow at the James McGregor Burns Academy of Leadership at Churchill College, University of Cambridge, and a member of the Yale African Women's Leadership Network. We met many years ago working together on a leadership training for the women of Afghanistan and Kabul, where we became fast friends, and I am now assisting her with a report from this amazing conference. Habak Osman, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you again after so many years.
Yes, and live from Cairo, I might add. You're our first guest from Cairo.
Well, fantastic. I mean, you are in my favorite city, Washington, D.C.
So for those who are not familiar with your work, can you just say, like, why did you organize this conference with women from the Mideast and North Africa?
Well, as you know, this year, this month, first of all, the 8th of March was the Women's International Women's Day. Mm-hmm. And this whole month, women are celebrating, women's issues. And usually from the 15th to the 24th of March, the whole world, women in the world, descend in New York. And it's called the Commission on the Status of Women. So unfortunately, this year, of course, and last year, we went to New York and we all did what we could in our own countries. So the conferences where we usually have in New York, you know, we all had it here. And that what that means is, you know, we all come together, find out exactly what's missing, what we did, what worked, what didn't in terms of women's rights and where we need to do more. Listen from the ones that have succeeded in doing and implementing, pushing, you know, women's rights, and those who had blocks, and you know, and see where they could learn from others who were also able to move those blocks, you know, from women's rights issues, and to see exactly what's the best way of pushing policymakers to implement, come up with laws that protect women.
Fantastic. And this may be a silver lining with this COVID pandemic is that you probably had a lot more women participating from the ground in your virtual three-day conference than would have been able to show up in New York City. So, and I know one of the ones that struck me is a woman calling in from Yemen in the middle of the war in her country, and she takes the time to come to be with you and the other women to talk about what's going on and what needs to happen. So you did an incredible job of bringing really frontline women, top flight, together to talk about these important issues. So,
well, you know, it's absolutely nobody's joining, you know,
Nobody's what?
Oh, yeah, we saw the internet, of course, is unstable every now and then. But yes, it's no, I mean, no one would have chosen to be in New York, but the international, you know, the United Nations is in New York. So this is also the underlying thing is to pushing governments to A, recognize and support women's issues. Mm-hmm. And this whole March is the one month that everyone is thinking about women's rights. I mean, as women, we are always thinking about women's issues. But it just so happens that this is the time that everybody comes together and does that. So we'd, of course, you know, preferred it to be, we do all the work in our own countries and go there so that we can celebrate each other and all that. But yes, she was calling from Yemen, and she's, Ula is one of the strongest youngsters I've ever met. I think she's about 20 or 21. And she's doing so much work on the ground. And this is the thing, because one of the things that we like to do is to celebrate the work that women are doing, really. Mm-hmm. In the worst circumstances, you know, in Libya, you have people like Zahra Langi, who you met, who is not only doing work, but she you know, she and her other Libyan, you know, partners and friends are pushing for laws and drafting a new constitution and making sure, you know, women's rights laws are there. Because if you don't have women, then, of course, it's a bunch of men who are going to come up with whatever they think, you know, will be right for women. I mean, they would be thinking, doing all the thinking for us as usual, you know.
Are not and, thinking of us at all.
Never. Yes. The only reason they think is how many obstacles they can put, you know, for us to accomplish what we need to. And, you know, we were just talking about that today. I mean, women. It's not just a question of just women. Women are the core of the family and the society. Mm-hmm. And if you, and I think, you know, this is where, you know, fundamentalism and conservatives everywhere in any religion, you know, they spend so much time and effort of how much they are going to control women. They think women are crisis to manage, when the fact of the matter is women are the best crisis managers. You look at COVID, if you look at wars. So if you look at Ulaya, again, going back to her, she's doing incredible work. And so there are women in Yemen and Syria, in Libya, that, you know, it's very hard to think about them, but the amount of work they're doing, mm-hmm, is unbelievable. I think the only reason, you know, those countries are, it's as if they don't even understand there's war going on. If you look at, you know, drafting the constitution, pushing for women to have quotas, getting leadership trainings, going back to their own countries when it's, you know, war, or just being in the diaspora, but it's still advocating to go back and to make sure the system changes and to influence policymakers. And many people are, of course, excited about Biden and what he's going to bring at the table and stopping the wars and stopping selling weapons that are, mm-hmm, going to be turned against, you know, the people, you know, by irresponsible governments, and really bringing women to the table. But I tell you, something, the wars are not going to stop unless women are in that leadership. They are the ones at the table, they're the ones who are, you know, at the discussion, and they're the ones who are taking the leadership.
But exactly this, right,
men in suits going in and out meetings is pathetic. And this is not only for our region, but if you look at it, you know, at the United Nations, just watch anything, you know, you'll find men in suits going in and out supposedly for, you know, for peace, you know, meetings and all of that. So what we do is, you know, making sure that women are in these meetings and pushing them and making sure they, you know, they are really speaking for the community. The thing is, women are in the community. When war happens, they're the ones who are providing the education. They're the ones who are helping in health. They're the ones who are trying to keep the family safe. Mm-hmm. So unless you actually have those women, and they're the ones who know exactly what the priorities and the need is for the community, unless you have those women coming to these meetings, then you really are talking to yourself. You might as well talk to the wall, because the factions and politicians are basically there to negotiate positions. They're not there so that they can get. This is why the wars are still going on in Libya, in Syria, in all of these places, in Yemen. Because the men cannot agree who's going to have what position. And that's not just saying it, it's the truth.
Right. Well, it seems to me that we won't have peace in the world until we have peace in the Mideast. And we won't have peace in the Mideast until women are included in both the peacemaking and government decision-making. Would you agree with that?
You will not have peace unless American foreign policy changes. American foreign policy has been three things: to, you know, protect Israel, to fight terrorism, and to protect their interest in oil. So it's far more complicated than that, but something has to change that. And sometimes, you know, the way people who live in the Middle East feel is no matter who comes in, the American foreign policy is going to be those three things. So hopefully there is a new dawn. The women are absolutely out there. And I think hopefully, you know, Biden will bring a balancing act, because I think everybody benefits if there is peace in the Middle East. And you're rightfully, you know, what you said is right, that, you know, this unless there is a solution for this, too many wars going on in the Middle East, no one's going to feel safe.
Right.
Anywhere, and, you know.
Right, exactly. And speaking of a new day, we all thought there would be a new day 10 years ago with the Arab Spring. But what do you see has happened? I know it's a it's a big and complex region, and there's different countries have had different experiences. But overall, what would you say has happened since Arab Spring? Have the countries moved more towards freedom, or was there a backlash to more repression, or both, depending on where you are?
Well, you know, some people call it, you know, I think in the West they call it Arab Spring, but it really became an Arab night eventually. For many countries, it became Arab nightmare, because the protests that happened, when they happened in Libya, people were expecting things to change for the better. Democracy, human rights, is justice. I mean, the protests that started in 2010, you know, they offered a chance to address the injustices and inequalities, you know, but it just became too chaotic. And, you know, to stabilize the smooth course of the revolutions, it was never clear, you know, exactly what's going on. A lot of times it was leaderless. But those who were more organized, I think in many countries, the ones that were organized were the more conservative ones. So even though it started with masses of people and women bringing their children in Tahrir Square and, you know, and in Freedom Square and all these places, and they were at the forefront, once the transition started taking, it was only the men who were in who were basically trying to, you know, to sabotage and to take over. And that was it. They left behind the youth, they left behind the women. And the conservatives basically took advantage of it, even though they were not in the, you know, in the beginning, they were not part of, let's say, of the protests. I think it took a couple of days for them to even join. But later on, when the transition took over, they were the ones who were more organized, had more resources, and basically left everyone behind. So, you know, that whole dream of pushing for justice just became less. Elections happened. The conservatives were, you know, elected to, you know, to the parliament. They got more seats. Women, they say, you know, actually voted in Egypt for, you know, the more conservative party and all that. But once the transition took over, they left behind those who absolutely were at the forefront of the revolution. So, but the good thing is, you know, people lost that, you know, they lost that whole idea of fear. So yes, there are more people who are collaborating now. There are more organizations. People are not in fear in many places. They actually feel they were out there and they gained and they got rid of dinosaur, you know, systems, and they could do it again. So that, you know, there's more discussion and more, let's say, you know, groups coming together. And that's it. But of course, you know, if you look at the women's rights, really much hasn't changed. I mean, for example, if you look at the law that everyone was protesting against, of course, you know, the rape law to sort of punish rapists, you know, and, you know, three countries passed that, Lebanon, Jordan, and Tunis in 2017. And they're still fighting to implement it. It's there. But if you have conservatives in the parliament who's going to pass it. And then the other politicians, there's no political will. Because no matter what, they will, you know, I don't think this law would have been passed without the revolutions. Because the women are more organized and more daring. You know, they are not in fear. But when you do that, then the problem comes, those who are in parliament are not passing it. You know, they're blocking it. Mm-hmm. So the revolution, absolutely. I mean, a lot of people gave their lives. You know, it gave hope to many people. People absolutely are not in fear to organize and protest. But there is also a lot of disappointments because ordinary people were the ones that made the difference. But then again, they were asking at that time for schools and health and jobs. None of it happened. So when you ask them now again to go into the streets, the first thing they would tell you is, what have we gained? So it was certainly a good idea, but it's a process. It's a process. Politics is a process.
Right. And speaking of women's rights, there's been a lot of work done around the problem of gender-based violence. And it really struck me in listening to the women at the conference, really how many places their progress has been made. So do you want to talk a little bit about maybe the experience in Tunisia and some of the other countries where there's been some progress made on women's rights, particularly around violence against women?
Well, you know, like I started, they definitely, they have passed law 2017 that is supposed to protect, before the law was introduced to end violence against women. Women were basically traditionally, were forced to marry their rapist, basically, you know.
Women were forced to marry their rapist.
Oh, absolutely. They're rapists. Yeah, that was just a tradition, not only in the Arab region, but in Africa, in many places.
Whoa.
Yeah. And that's it, you know. And so this law was so important, to be, and it was the women who were pushing this. But unfortunately, you would think this will, pass and would have support, but it didn't. Women are still fighting it. So for years, they were fighting to bring the law. And finally, yes, it was passed. And now there will be another 10 years of fighting it, to implement it. And it's not going to happen until you have more women in parliament and more women in important positions to push this. And more important is to have a woman who has a womanist agenda. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just good enough to have a woman in parliament, but women who really count, you know? And a lot of women lost their lives, in the revolution. So it's, someone who we worked with, Selwa Bogagis, lost her life. The last day that she casted her vote, she was murdered. So women were targets, at the time. So women really paid in blood for the revolution,
Wow.
So there's still, of course, lobbying to increase women's political participation, women's rights, changing the law. In Egypt, they drafted a law. It has 18, women's rights articles right there. But the question is, you have to implement it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there were gains. It doesn't, the revolution is, it's a process. It's really a process, but people are getting used to making demands.
Right. And I was struck too by the support of women who came in. For example, the woman who was the vice prime minister in Spain, who had talked about being there when Franco had a repressive regime in Spain. And then getting him out and then reconstructing the society after him and the challenge that women had there, but that she talked about how important it is to have the framework of the laws. First, you want to get those laws passed. And secondly, once they're passed, that's not enough. You need to keep pushing to get them implemented. And I definitely heard that, you know, the struggle for both passing the laws that are good laws for women and for the society more generally, and then also the challenge on implementing the laws once they're passed. So you've got kind of a two-step challenge to go through to make changes for women, right?
Well, true. But it's very interesting because she also pointed out that, you know, during that time, it was actually, Franco was talking to the church, and the church was so repressive that they basically wanted to abolish all the women's rights. They basically told the women to go back to the kitchen and discouraged them to come. And again, if you look at the, for example, in our parts of the world, it's the same thing. It's the religious, traditions and cultures that basically are repressive. So all that's what we, that's what, it's not just only for Muslims, but it's for Christians, for Jews, for everyone. It's the organized religion that basically reduces, the rights of women. Even when during the revolution, when women absolutely, pushed for these laws, for example, violence against women and other laws to have women to participate fully, influential lobbies in parliament, were absolutely blocking and plotting to reverse the progress. They were absolutely moving to abolish protections for women, reducing the legal age of marriage to just 9 years old.
Oh my God.
That was called the Ja'fari law in Iraq in 2017. It was 2017. Can you imagine?
Terrible.
But the good thing is there has been...
Did they pass that? Did they pass that thing?
No, the woman fought, but they're still fighting. In Tunis, it became... Women became critical. They became a critical electoral bloc,
Mm-hmm.
And succeeded to put progressive people like Bajid Abdi Esabi in 2014 in parliament, and to be the president, and it was under his leadership that the country passed so many progressive laws. So this is the thing, when women really are organized, when they get together, when they have the chance and the space given to them to vote, they become really very meaningful electoral, a bloc.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what has happened in Tunis. They were able to do that. It's very important.
Yeah, well, and the fact that women formed that electoral bloc in Tunis led to what the women were talking about, like a gold standard of laws around women's rights and dealing with gender-based violence. It sounds like a terrific law. Now, I know, of course, there's always challenges of implementation, but at least they got the law on the books, and it's a very solid law. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, it's three countries, not just only Tunis. There was Jordan and Lebanon also, but they are all faced the same problem. Yes, the woman, pushed for it. It passed, and everyone now is like, well, what happened to the 2017 laws? None of it has been, it has passed, but it hasn't been implemented. So this is why it was important to bring the judges, the lawyers, the constitutional experts to see exactly where do we go from here, what's happening, and to talk to the women activists and say, where is the problem? And everyone agreed. First of all, the culture. There are still people who believe, the culture, it's very difficult. You can bring all the laws in the world, but if the culture is not supportive, it becomes that much difficult.
Exactly.
So that's why talking to religious, scholars, and making sure that this is in sync with the culture, it's important. It's unfortunate But, you know, beating up the woman and raping, can no religion will be supportive of that. You see? So basically bringing these scholars to basically, you know, make the case that this is wrong culturally and religiously and socially and in every which way. It's one of the reasons why it passed, because those who were trying to block this could not really justify and make the case, because usually what they fail in everything else, then they say, oh, it's the religion. So when you really, you know, bring in scholars to say, no, that is wrong and misinterpretation. I don't know if you remember, but everyone was talking about misinterpretation of this and that.
Right.
It's important, because then they have absolutely no justification. So it's an uphill fight. But the great thing is there were times you couldn't fight even. It was that, yeah, and people thought it was really wrong. So there are a lot of women who benefited from the protection, you know, of other women setting up shelters and hotlines and, you know, accompanying them to the courts and taking them, you know, hiring lawyers for them and all that. So it's much, much better, you know. Again, the families are more conservative, of course, it's by the time a woman comes to a shelter, you know, that's it. She's running, you know, fleeing for her life.
Right.
And yeah, still, it's not okay in some other cultures, because they interpret when you talk about women fleeing, with her kids or by herself to a shelter, they look at that as breaking the family up. And yeah, my thing is, seriously, I mean, what family? He's beating her. And now, of course, COVID made things even worse, because you have your abuser in the same house, you know, and he's there going nowhere. There's no work. So violence against women absolutely tripled.
Right, exactly. And, you know, it's fascinating. You've got the challenge, as you say, of the culture. You know, we're talking many, many years of a culture where the men ruled and the men were seen as, you know, the king of the family and supposed to have the women in submission and assert his authority, backed up by these conservative religious views. But like you say, a lot of this so-called Sharia law is dramatically misinterpreted. There was a male judge there, I think he was from Libya, who gave the case of where the Sharia law says a man cannot take another wife without the permission of his first wife. And yet the courts were absolutely taking the exact opposite interpretation of the law, saying, well, a man can take a second wife and doesn't need to ask his first wife about it. So that absolutely saying the opposite of what Sharia law says. How widespread is that misinterpretation of Sharia law?
You know, for a moment, I thought America was really heading towards that.
You and me both.
Really, really. First of all, I'm one of those people who really believes that, you know, I think, you know, civil law should be, everyone should be under the Constitution, under protection of the national Constitution. Many people will tell you most of the constitutions in our region, for example, and in some parts in Africa, is based under the Sharia, but that's it. It's not, you know. But when you start interpreting and misinterpreting and then doing it's really complicated. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's very important that there is, some countries that are working on, the personal status law, which will basically, everyone will be, under that. So if you tell, you know, to me, okay, so yeah, yes, that's what it says. A woman should say, okay, tell me a woman who is agreeing her husband to marry four wives, and then But it also says that if you can economically afford them and if you can economically support them the same. And so it gets too complicated, and it's easier to simplify it and say, under the Constitution, this is the law and everyone should adhere to it. But once you get into the Sharia, it really gets very complicated. You know?
Right, exactly.
People are fighting over, you know, the personal status in law, and it's very, very complicated to even explain.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I think this is why we were having the discussion with the judges, because they, you know, the law should be black and white. The law should be very clear. The law should not be, you know, when it comes to the rights of women, a woman should not be beaten. A husband should have only one wife, because that's the only, you know, way he can afford, or whatever it is, you know. It should be very clear.
Right, exactly.
In the culture and tradition, and what are we talking about? Seriously.
Right, and the women were talking about situations where the civic law might say one thing, but the Sharia law might have another take on it, and when they're not compatible, like which one rules? And you know, it seems like a lot of the fact that Sharia law is so embedded in the culture that you've got to deal with all of that, even once you do pass a good law protecting women's rights.
This is why we are pushing for more young women to go into law. You know, this is why we are pushing that, you know, more women should be, you know, judges. You know, that's why we are pushing international law should be respected when certain things are not in your, you know, are concerned. And look, women's issues is an ongoing, you know, thing. But the most important thing is we have really, you know, you have to help yourself. There's no help that's coming inside. Nobody's, and usually I feel like Western, thinking is always, we can come in and if you do 1, 2, 3, 4, we can liberate you from yourself. And that is not the way to do things. You have to work with what you have in the culture, in the religion, in, you know, and fight it right there, you know, and make sure that everyone's right is protected, period. It's not open for discussion when it comes to justice. Justice has one face, one way. You know, you can interpret and misinterpret justice. Justice is right and wrong, period. Once you get into a gray area, then you really know you're heading for a disaster. And it's unfortunate because it's always the woman. It's always the woman
who suffer
with a disaster and who suffer. You will not find a man that is like suffering because there is an interpretation and misinterpretation. What he should do, you know, to woman is very clear to him, and the law, the culture gives him that. But that's the thing. Look, it's, you know, we have to, changes in the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's because it just, what makes sense. And that's it. So that's why you met so many activists who are really working, but we are also very practical, and you have to work with, you know, you have to have a constituency that supports your new ideas. Any new idea people are not comfortable with, suspicious and all that. So you have to really work. You have to get the people on your side. I don't think any father is very happy his daughter to be beaten. I don't think any mother is happy when her daughter is killed for no reason. You know, in all, what they call honor, and there is no honor in killing a woman, but I don't know why it's, you know, like right now somebody was talking about, you know, refugee camps where if they suspect a woman is systematic, you know, corbeid, they will basically murder her in some places, you know, because they think if you take her to an isolated place and there are men, they don't trust her, so they would rather kill that husband, wife or daughter or whatever it is, then let her go where they think there's men. So the tradition is very, very, you know, you know, it's there. And I think it's exasperated. It, you know, things were progressing nicely in some countries, but after the war, you know, it just went back. You know, the regression is unbelievable. People are more conservative. There is when they, you know, when you find yourself in a refugee camp, what is going, you have no constitution, you are stateless, nothing, what is going to protect you? And the UN's job is just to keep everyone there, and if they can feed, that's fine. If they can shelter, that's fine, because countries will not let you build their schools and hospitals for the refugees because they don't want to integrate them in their society. They want to keep them in the camps. So again, it's complicated. But of course, things can be done, but it needs a political will and the resources to do that.
Right. Political will and resources. And as you say, dealing with the deep traditions and custom. But that's part of what the international community, is, at least at times, has tried to be helpful. So, for example, in 2010, the UN Security Council passed a resolution on women, peace, and security known as Resolution 1325. And the idea was to get more women in the negotiations for peace and more women rebuilding the countries. There was hope that that would help bring about peace more quickly and would strengthen women's rights around the world. What do you think of Resolution 1325? Has it been helpful? Has it made any difference whatsoever?
I think, you know, any resolution that comes out is not binding. It's not legal. It's under, it's basically, it's non-binding. It's a resolution. It's non-binding. And it's up to the government in each country to do something about it, to come up with the resources, to have national action plans for that and all this. And let's say out of the 22 countries, let's say in the Arab region, only four, I think three have a genuine one, I think, and one attempted. That's it. No one else has it. When you are asking governments, because what Resolution 1325 basically says, protection of women and participation of women, should, you know, women should be participating in all the peace agreements. Mm-hmm. Throughout peace agreements everywhere, they should be involved. They should be involved in the humanitarian, you know, recovery and reconstruction. They should be, you know, and nothing's being done because governments, you are talking to governments who you are already fighting to implement laws that protect women, even though it was passed, still they're not able to enforce or implement it. Now you're coming back and saying, hey, we need you to send women in this peace, you know, agreements, in this peace meetings, and they should be involved in the peace process. And we want you to come up with the resources to support that. They're not going to do that. Where are they going to get the money from? Mm-hmm. They're not going to. They will put the money somewhere else, but the last thing they would think is so that women would have a leadership, you know, in any of these processes. That's one. The UN as an international institution also failed miserably because the idea is you still have men in voice. You always hear, oh, the Syrian envoy. It's a man, usually a European man. You know, Libya, a European man. And one is in a blue moon when they have a woman. It's a white woman, not even from the region. And it, there is just a disconnect with the resolution. It could have been a good resolution, but still it needs to be the peace itself, the peace process itself in all these countries needs to be decolonized. The language of the resolution, who is in control of the resolution so far, the ones that are paying for all these peace agreements, are also the same people who are also, you know, giving weapons and manufacturing weapons. So sometimes you think this is just a PR. It's a good idea for women to be participating in the peace process because women are working with the communities. And you will know in that agreement, you would have, the priorities of the people, ordinary people, in this, in the peace agreements and the peace processes, and it has a chance. They say 15% of the time, if women were involved, it has a chance, to be sustained. The peace, agreement will be sustained if women were involved. That, that's a study that said that. So the point is, we don't have to prove to ourselves that if women get involved in the peace processes, peace could be or will be actually sustained. So 1325 as a resolution, it is fine. Implementing it, if you think half of the countries are at war anyway, what are they going to implement? If when you tell them bring a woman at the table, they will basically bring women as a tablecloth, because they will bring their own, cronies, and the militias or whatever it is, the opposition will bring their own women. So these are not women, because these are not women who are representing women or have women's agenda or even representing the constituency or the people. So mm-hmm. This isn't for them. It's like a decoration. Okay, let's just bring the woman. That's fine. But you have to be, if you have a woman in voice, if you after 20 years have failed miserably to bring in, to have women participate in this peace processes, then you have to think out of the box and create a mechanism to have the woman there anyway. This is the UN. The UN cannot just wait for governments to decide they're going to send women or not, actually, or civil society. So resolution, yes, it could be good. It basically gives you the legitimacy to talk about what we are talking about, the lack of women's participation. And, it just gives you that legitimacy. You have to fight. So women are continuously in the ring. You call that the ring. Yani they're fighting and boxing their way through.
Mm-hmm.
But at least, it's fine. It says that women should be, there. Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm here in, in Washington, D.C., and we have remarkably, we're going down a very slippery slope, even in the United States, of having an authoritarian leader, having really deep corruption in the government, people paying off to get pardons from jail and all kinds of favors from the president. We've had the fundamentalist Christians here trying to push women back into the kitchen and out of public life. And so fortunately, enough of us rallied to elect Joe Biden into the White House now. And he's been on fire doing a fabulous job. If you were to sit down and talk with Joe Biden, what are the top three things that you would want the United States to do right now for Mideast and North Africa?
Well, absolutely. To America has not been involved, not only for the last, 4 years, but even it gave up, I think, way before that, to really bring peace to this region. So continuous engagement, full mm-hmm. political, economic, social engagement is extremely important. But to also make sure that you really are building, first of all, you have to work very hard to bring the trust of people. America has reached to the point where nobody really trusts them. You can't do much if the majority of the people don't trust you, or your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a continuation of talking to the people, building trust,
mm-hmm.
Proving that you are balanced and willing. And it all starts with effective listening. I mean, you and I, as students of political science, you really have to listen what the people are saying, and you don't need government mediums. Governments, you meet with them, that's fine, but you need to meet with civil society, with religious leaders, with traditional people. With if I was Joe Biden, I would spend most of my time two ways. The diplomatic part, which is how do we stop this war? Who should be really the mediators and negotiators at the table? And the other one will be the social and building trust, the people. So, yeah, America really has, you know, lost credibility in many ways. So bringing that credibility back and making sure for the first time to be connected, because America was always connected to the leaders who were corrupt and dictators. So there was absolutely no trust. It trusted whatever system was there because America was thinking about America first, for the lack of a better word. But I think, you know, it's very clear that after so many years of just listening to those who are in power, did not work out. And if you are still trying to bring dictators to the table to bring peace, that is not going to work out either. So trying to find another way, another radical way, you know, is very important. So there's no one way of basically saying, okay, this is how we're going to deal with the Middle East. But there are so many different ways. Building that trust is important, diplomatic, but you really need the right people assigned to explain what America really wants to do and to listen to what people are really, want. And people want peace, people want jobs, people want health. And none of that could happen without peace. So how do we tackle that? You know, there's not going to be any democracy with absolutely no peace. There is no peace without democracy. So what are you going to do? You know, so it's a long-term engagement of the people and diplomatic engagement. Well, if you try to solve these problems, people would absolutely, would basically see you as a serious person. But that's it. It's not one way or the other. It's together. Mm-hmm. To do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, people are watching Biden and, what they would, he definitely handled COVID very well.
So, he's doing a fantastic job.
If he could handle, the war the way he has handled COVID, I think he has a better chance of people trusting him.
Right. What about this tension, for Biden and his foreign policy team, where on the one hand, they want to support the American values with, peace and democracy and women's rights. But then some of the people in the Mideast might go, well, that's the West trying to push their agenda on us. We don't really want women's rights. What would you say to that argument?
I don't think anybody's going to say we don't want. Of course, if you're going to talk to fundamentalists, please go ahead. They will tell you, please. And yeah, there were times America was siding with that because they didn't understand. They were very ignorant about actually the Middle East and the people, and they thought everyone was a fundamentalist or a potential fundamentalist. So they had to deal with the fundamentalists to understand them because they felt fundamentalists would be the ones who are ruling the country. Look, the issue of democracy, human rights, and justice does not have color, culture, religion. It's one way. America cannot push and say, okay, well, they used to have institutions to basically spread the American value. We know where American value has landed. It has landed war. It has landed, selling weapons to irresponsible governments. It has landed, wherever they go, they just, droning Somalia to the hilt when Somalia is poor and, at war and all this, and they were droning without, there was absolutely no accountability for American involvement. American involvement has been negative. American involvement has not been positive. Whether it's in Africa or whether it's a continuation of war or on the verge of war or supporting this against that. So America does not have a good record,
Right.
But fact of the matter is we are all interdependent and we have to find a way to work together. And there is a certain level of, I think you have reached to the point of God knows what, you know, for the last 4 years, even though the other 4 years before that, when it comes to foreign policy, it was not necessarily the best for some countries. There was no engagement, like I said. It just it was a wishy-washy. But if there is a serious, you know, engagement, we can work together because, you know, everybody wants justice. So the first, you know, the first thing is to stop giving weapons to irresponsible governments, to, you know, get engaged in bringing peace to the region, working together with the people to bring peace to Yemen, to Syria, to Libya, to Somalia, to all of these places, you know, and getting and then working on trust with the people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Really. I think that's dialogue and listening, and anyone who really, America is known for a quick fix, but quick fix ain't gonna fix anybody here. You know, if you're not willing to take the time that it needs, you know, it will be another wash-washiness and, you know, a couple of projects here and there, but yeah.
Yeah,
the quartus, if you don't take, I think what's at stake is the American leadership. If you are not going to, and I think this is where Biden administration is trying to do, is back, you know, that leadership, you know. Others are going to fill that void. And they might not be necessarily the best thing that's going to happen, you know, to this world. So there's a fight for that. And I think you show your leadership if you start with the Middle East and Africa, of course.
Right. So
there is more. There is more, you know, for America to really, I think America needs to be, needs the Middle East, needs Africa to show leadership, leadership with humility, you know, and engagement, you know, with the people. But if it's going to be, okay, we're going to give you more weapons so you could be our friends and we're going to bribe you here and there and whatever, it's not going to work. Others cannot wait to basically, you know, fill that void. They have already been. So, yeah, you know, you need that balance. So it's really, there's more for you in this, you know, then there's more for both of us to work together. I think this region and the U.S. to make sure to bring stabilization.
Right. And it seems to me, you know, instead of sending these weapons into Yemen and other places in the Middle East, that instead of like throwing fuel on the fire, America could play a constructive role by helping to shore up the genuine efforts for peace and democracy, human rights, women's rights within the region. Would you agree with that?
America should work with the priorities of the people. You know, women's rights are absolutely going to go on, you know, and working for justice and all of that. So absolutely, the people who are, they should be talking to, of course, are different, you know, sectors of the society, in which part, of course, are women's rights and civil society and, you know, the traditional leaders and all of that. Yeah. And of course, you know, governments who are there, you cannot ignore them. You have to also, you know, engage with them, but not just only them, you know. So, yeah, look, the weakness of America is shown when America is, I don't know what the English word is. I think it's like, you know, withdraws politically and economically and socially and all that from the Middle East, the hottest place on earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's when you feel the void, you know?
I think the world was missing the United States over the past 4 years.
It really is. It really is. Because the fact of the matter is, you know, most of the people who are here went to school there. There has always been cultural, you know, it has always been, you know, all the young boys and girls and everybody wants, you know, listening to American music and all this and all that. America has always been the place to be, or the place to be friends with, or the place that, you know, you desire. Yeah, it became, you know, it was the place to run to, even if you are war or whatever, but it became a place to run from,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that the ignorance was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, the Muslim ban and the hijab ban and the danger, the same that's happening now with the Asian, you know, Americans and Pacific. It's intolerable. I mean, really, this is intolerable. What is going to happen? If it's not the blacks, then it's Asians. If it's not the Asians, it's, you know, the gays. If it's not the gays, it's this. What is going on?
Well, the good news is we did get Trump out. We got Biden in. And as Biden said when he was elected, America is back. So we're hoping to have a much better administration and a turn of things here. But we can empathize with some of the challenges of repressive regimes and corruption now worldwide, that we see no country is immune from that. And it requires the vigilance of we the people to fight for democracy, for peace, for human rights and women's rights.
Right. Yeah, I think the sad part about America was it legitimized the dictatorship, did, you know, things they used to be afraid because they, you know, they were afraid to be ostracized, you know, internationally and all that. So it became legitimate for them to jail, to torture, to loot, to do whatever, because America was not, that was happening in America too. So that was the saddest part, because that was one place that was sort of the standard, you know, in terms of, yeah, there was at least, America was never perfect, but at least, you know, there was accountability. So to
right.
watch, yeah.
Well, we're climbing back, so let's climb up together.
I think you could learn a lot from us. I think the American woman could learn a lot from the woman in this region and Africa of how they have really
survived, you know, and thrived despite repressive regimes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
So, do
and
come.
Yes, thank you. Well, let's keep this dialogue going, and I pledge to lifelong engagement with you and the other women in the Mideast. So,
well, we love you. You know that, Eleanor, and we're hoping to see you and for you to come back.
Thank you.
Let's build a, you know, the relationship.
Yes, and that's all the time we have for today. Habak Osman, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work for peace, human rights, and women's rights.
Thank you very much.